Whether you're quarantined in the house or not, you still don't want your gym bag being all nasty. Our sponsor today, Manscaped, is here to make sure your stuff stays in check. Manscaped promotes clean hygiene when it comes to your junk thanks to their Lawnmower 3.0. Manscaped is the only men's brand dedicated to below-the-waist grooming. While you're probably at home looking for something to do, why not make manscaping a part of your new routine? You don't want to look like you're sitting on men's shoulders from WCW. And you don't want Brutus the Barber Beefcake chomping away down there. And you dang sure don't want to use that Freebird hair removal cream. Manscaped is forever changing the grooming game with their Perfect Package 3.0. Precision engineered tools for your family jewels. The Perfect Package 3.0 kit comes with new and improved Lawnmower 3.0, waterproof, cordless body trimmer, and a ton of other liquid formulations to round out your manscaping routine. This third generation trimmer features a cutting edge ceramic blade to prevent manscaping accidents. Your goods are going to be nick free thanks to Manscaped's advanced skin safe technology. Inside the Perfect Package, you'll also find the Manscaped Crop Preserver, an anti-chafing deodorant and moisturizer. You're probably sitting on the couch like Al Bundy right now anyway, so you might as well keep everything smooth and fresh. Subscribe to the Perfect Package to get a new replacement blade refill for your lawnmower trimmer delivered to your door every 3 months, making sure your trimmer stays fresh and clean. And for a limited time, subscribers get not one, but two free gifts: the Shed Travel Bag, $39 value, and the patented high-performance anti-chafing Manscaped Boxer Briefs. This is the perfect package for your perfect package. Get 20% off and free shipping with code SLOPDROP at manscaped.com. That's SLOPDROP, SLOPDROP. Do yourself a favor and always use the right tools for the job. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com by using the promo code SLOPDROP, SLOPDROP.
That's a slop drop. I can answer that. That's a slop drop. What is that move? That's a slop drop.
Slop drop time. That's a slop drop. Oh, that is a slop drop.
Slop drop, slop drop.
A slop drop.
The slop drop indeed.
What's up, humanoids? Welcome back to the Slop Drop. This is Nathan Rogers at WooPigSumo on Twitter, and I'm joined by the unluckiest man in the world, Bad Luck Chapman, and the manager of champions, Stephen E. What's up, gentlemen?
What is going on, Nathan?
Well, I have the bad luck of everybody in the world. You're the one with the Rona.
Yeah, you've passed on your bad luck. To address the elephant in the room, I shaved my beard temporarily, but it will be back. No, for real, Chapman just mentioned it. Obviously, this show's a few days delayed, and the reason being, this is Friday the 13th, by the way. So, Friday night, Wednesday night, I tested positive for the coronavirus and strep throat. So, I'm rocking this one at 101 point something fever, but I feel great. And how are you, Joe?
Oh, man.
It's Friday the 13th. It's Chapman. It's like a national holiday for Chapman.
It not only is
this has been my year.
Not only is it Friday the 13th, but it's Friday the 13th, 2020.
Which is
how much worse can it get? Why don't we ask him? How much worse can it get?
Oh, you have no idea.
This is a dumpster fire.
Man, I'm telling you.
23 years ago this week, WWF Survivor Series, November 9th, 1997, from Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
Welcome, everyone, to the 11th annual Survivor Series. We are live in the sold-out Molson Center in Montreal, Quebec, where tonight it will finally be settled. Who is the man? Is it Bret the Hitman Hart? Or is it Comfortable Shawn Michaels? Hi again, everybody. I'm Jim Ross, alongside Jerry the King Lawler. King, this one has been 18 months in the making.
The 11th annual Survivor Series attendance was 20,593, 250,000 pay-per-view buys. They made $447,284 at the gate and sold $137,000 worth of merch. So not a bad night for the WWE in O Canada.
No. And everybody knows when you talk about Survivor Series 97, what it's infamous for, everybody knows, right? Everybody talks about Survivor Series 97. Everybody knows that was the debut of Steve Blackman.
It was. WWF champions going into this event. World champion was Bret Hart. Intercontinental champion was Owen Hart. The European champion was Shawn Michaels, and the tag champions was the Legion of Doom, the Road Warriors. Commentators Jim Ross and Jerry the King Lawler. Interviewers Kevin Kelly, Michael Cole, and Michael P.S. Hayes.
Yeah. I tell you what, watching this pay-per-view makes me realize how much I was entertained by Jim Ross and the King. And they were amazing. And during that time period, it was just unbelievable. I mean, you know, you could literally just sit there and listen to them talk and be entertained. Yeah. And just talk and just watch them talk about what they're seeing. And it just, that's one of the things that I think wrestling today lacks is, you know, storytellers like that.
Well, you used to have Gorilla and Bobby, mm-hmm. and they were just that match made in heaven. And then you've got Lawler and JR that are kind of that generation's Gorilla and Bobby. And now you don't. I mean, you've got the best thing that I've heard is JR and Tony Schiavone. But that's, you know, a lot of that's just the nostalgia part of it.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, Vince and Jesse was underrated too. I thought they were.
Yeah. Yeah, they were. You know, you know what I loved about that is, you know, here you got Vince McMahon, owner of the company. But, you know, from a fan's perspective, maybe, you know, behind the scenes, everybody knew who it was. But, you know, kayfabe was pretty deep back then. And a lot of people didn't know Vince was the mastermind of the company. And, you know, to have him out
until
there
this event
with somebody, you know, to have him out there with somebody that could go tit for tat with him and kind of give it to Vince. It was a great combination.
Maple Leaf loving freaks, you're about to find out the true meaning of Southern justice. I see that Steers and Clears have already made their way to the ring. Well, now all you real true to life Yankee bastards are gonna see what Southern justice is all about. Black tracks and butt bangers, you are done for.
First match of the night, the Godwins and the New Age Outlaws defeated the Headbangers, Mosh and Thrasher, and the New Blackjacks, Blackjack Bradshaw, which was JBL, and Blackjack Windham, Barry Windham, in a classic 4-on-4 Survivor Series elimination match. Eliminations went as follows. Bradshaw eliminated Henry Godwin. Phineas Godwin eliminated Barry Windham. Billy Gunn eliminated Mosh. Thrasher eliminated Phineas. Road Dogg eliminated Bradshaw. And Billy Gunn eliminated Thrasher.
He was trying to negotiate some sort of pump handle slam there before Thrasher was able to canter out of it with a hip lock.
I saw a tag.
Yeah, blind tag. Oh, look out, it was reversed. Oh, but Billy's the legal man. Billy Gunn right off the top. And Billy Gunn and the Road Dogg have survived.
I don't know if you noticed at the end, there was a botch or two here. Road Dogg tried the pump handle slam two different times. Didn't work. And then Billy Gunn comes off the top rope and misses by about 2 feet. But
Yeah. I tell you what, when you go back and you watch that, man, one of the things that I remember just how hot the crowd was. The crowd was amazing. It was loud. It was super, super loud. And that Canadian crowd, boy, they hated Billy Gunn. You know, I mean, it was crazy to go back and watch that and just to hear the heat that he was getting. You know, of course, being in Canada, it was kind of topsy-turvy. All of the good-blooded Americans were getting booed out of the building.
Yeah. Billy Gunn and Road Dogg were the sole survivors. This was the beginning of the New Age Outlaws.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
The Truth Commission defeated the Disciples of Apocalypse in a typical Survivor Series match. The Interrogator, later known as Kurgan, was a lone survivor.
Now it's up down to two men. The Interrogator
about to be down to one,
but not for long. What a slam! This big save.
getting the victory for the Truth Commission. Fun fact, 1 year after this, at the next Survivor Series, I was there in St. Louis and met Kurgan and Jackal, which was Don Callis. And to be honest, they wasn't very friendly.
Oh,
I don't know if they were trying to keep it kayfabe or they're just dicks, but.
I tell you what, you know, last week we were talking about the Mount Rushmore of tag teams. How in the world, Bad Luck, did we forget to put the Truth Commission up there?
We didn't.
They're on his Mount Rushmore factions.
Well, yeah, factions. But I tell you what, they were bad. They were horrible.
Yeah.
And I don't know if you remember at the time, Kurgan was on a monster push. I mean, that guy was just getting pushed to the moon. And, you know, everybody that was a true fan sitting there looking at it going, really? This guy? It's crazy. That match in general, you watch it, and what do you think? There was probably 20 sidewalks. It was horrible. But I don't know. If I had to rate the thing, I'd give it a 1 star.
Yeah, if that. This would be the last time that the DOA would be featured in its entity. And also Bryan Adams' final WWE pay-per-view is Crush. Kevin Kelly backstage interviewed Stone Cold Steve Austin about his neck injury.
Stone Cold, I know everybody's talking to you, asking questions online about your match.
Stupid questions. How's my neck? Am I concerned about the neck? You damn right I am. But you got to go out there and see, it's either sink or swim. Steve Austin doesn't sink. So you damn right I'm worried about it, but that's the bottom line. You got to live with these things and go on, and Steve Austin is going on. I don't need nobody feeling sorry for me because this is just something that happened.
More backstage interviews with Team USA and Team Canada.
Vader has assembled Team America. Let me take a minute to introduce them. The man they call Goldust, Mark Merrill, and Steve Blackman, the newcomer in town. Now, Team America and Vader, we don't have very much in common, except we don't like big mouth Canadians trash talking Americans, telling us how to think, telling us what to do, telling us how to act. So tonight, yeah, it's time. It's time to get bad. It's time to get back. And oh yeah, Team Canada, they're tough when it's 4-on-1. But tonight, look around you, Team Canada. It's 4 against 4. So it's just not Vader time tonight. No, it's America's time.
Mr. Blackman, 6 days ago on Raw, you needed a ticket to get into the arena in Hershey. Tonight, you're a member of Team USA. You must be nervous.
Well, I may not be experienced in WWF wrestling, but I'm certainly experienced in every other form of fighting known to man. And, you know, to me, a fight's a fight, so I'm ready.
You're in the Canadian domain, USA. Tonight, you will leave the ring losers, and Canada will be victorious.
Doug Furnace.
That's right. Oh, glory. What's there to glorify? I'll tell you what the American fans of WWF are about. They're about drug, crimes, slime, and now they have their new degenerates. Well, I used to be proud to be an American, but tonight I declare my independence. They say America, love it or leave it, I left.
Team Canada, British Bulldog, Doug Furnace, Jim Neidhart, and Phil LaFond defeated Team USA, Goldust, Mark Merrow, Steve Blackman, and Vader in a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. The lone survivor was...
Had one Canadian in
it. Yeah. Lone survivor was the British Bulldog. Again, Steve Blackman's WWE in-ring debut. It was announced just 6 nights before the pay-per-view that the Patriot was out due to a torn triceps. Blackman had saved Vader, I guess, on the previous Raw 6 days before on the go-home show. And they needed somebody to substitute for the Patriot, so insert an unknown Steve Blackman at the last minute, and you got a participant and you got a match. So problem was nobody had any idea who Steve Blackman was.
Well, no, and I'll tell you, man, the highlight of that entire match was when the British Bulldog picked up Vader and slammed him
Man.
Up over his head.
Yeah. Davey Boy Smith was a physical specimen, boy. That guy not only did he look like $1 million, but the guy was just strong AF. I mean, that guy was just tossing Vader around like he was his little brother or something, you know.
Wow. And that triceps injury to the Patriot never really fully recovered, and he was pretty much done. Also done, Jim the Anvil Neidhart. This was his final WWE pay-per-view as well.
Well, you know why you heard the story behind why Jim Neidhart was done after this.
Oh yeah, there's a few that follow suit.
Well, I'd say the main reason why he was done is because Vader botched and crushed that dude's nuts. there's a spot where he goes in, you know, and when you go in for an elbow on the leg, you know, you kind of hit it at the bend of the knee. If you go back and watch that, there's no hitting at the bend of the knee. He hits him with the inside of his armpit, right? Just if he was ever going to have kids after that, he wasn't going to be able to. Amazing stuff. Vader was a monster.
Yeah, and poor Neidhart. I was going to go a different route. I didn't know that Vader had crushed his nuts.
Yeah, I don't think that's why they sent him off. But boy, that would have been an easy send off. You know,
goodbye.
Yeah, that was one hell of a goodbye.
See a backstage interview with Mankind.
You referred to me as a pebble. You gave my soul, and you called me a pebble. So when I sink these two fingers deep inside your trembling, flabby jowls, and your eyes begin to pop out of your evil little mind, I'm going to ask you one simple question. Do I look like a pebble now? Do I? Have a nice day.
A fourth match, Kane defeated Mankind by pinfall after a tombstone piledriver. This was the in-ring debut of Kane. They also used the red lighting here, which I have never been a fan of. But in-ring debut of Kane, major pay-per-view with a win over Mankind.
Kane was huge. He looked huge. And the way that they, you know, the cameraman would you know, shoot from the ground up just made him look even more like a monster. That guy, he looked... He was just a monster. Literally, that guy was just jacked at the time. Walking down that aisle for that match, you just look at the size of he's a thick old boy. That boy was huge.
So as we talked earlier, you know, Mankind, man, that was some of his prime right then. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody could talk about ECW and his work over in Japan and even WCW stuff, but. You know, that was the Cactus Jack guy. This was the Mankind. And this, I feel like, is where he just really kind of came out of his shell. He became a fan favorite shortly after this. And, you know.
But this was like his lead up to his face run, if I'm not mistaken. Because I could be wrong, but I think he debuted Dude Love at Survivor or SummerSlam that year. And, you know, was kind of going through the motions. And if I'm not mistaken, could be wrong, but I think Kane tombstoned Mankind on the entrance, kind of leading up to this, and man, they just beat the piss out of each other.
Yeah. Michael Cole interviewed Commissioner Sergeant Slaughter and Vince McMahon backstage. Slaughter says there's plenty of security backstage to make sure the WWF title match still happens. Cole asked McMahon who he thinks will win, and he says, "I don't know.
We have extra security backstage at the locker room area, so nothing will happen back here. I assure you that."
Vince. It's important that WWF fans get to see this match. This match, of course, was to have happened on a number of occasions, and it did not for a number of reasons. Hopefully, we will have none of those reasons, and the fans of Montreal and the fans all over the world will get to see this extraordinary match with two of the greatest WWF superstars in history.
Vince, I'm going to put you on the hot seat now. Who's going to win?
I don't know.
I think there was some backstage speculation because they went, you know, kind of like you, whenever they ask, why would they ask that typically? Mm-hmm. You know, and so I think everybody kind of assumed something was going to happen, but maybe they didn't know. I think they did. But.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of a weird feeling, especially knowing what we know now. Looking back on the whole situation, you almost see the writing on the wall, so to speak.
Doc Hendricks, aka it
really
Michael.
Makes a question. Was this real, or was this kind of like, was this kind of the way that they wanted it to work out?
Yeah. Doc Hendricks, aka Michael P.S. Hayes, interviewed Team Shamrock for their match against the Nation of Domination.
That's right. We're here to take care of business. And I got the tag team champions of the WWF, Hawk and Animal. And speaking of survival, Ahmed Johnson's no stranger to that. And when we get in that ring, it's going to be time to knuckle up and take care of some of that criminal element. Tell him, Hawk.
It seems to me that there's a lot of criminal element amongst the WWF. Well, we are the sergeants of arms, and we're going to get rid of the riffraff, starting with a Nation of Domination. When we get done with you, you'll all be down, face down in a pool of blood, hoping you got a friend to tip you on your back so you don't drown in your own blood. What a rut.
Fifth match, Ken Shamrock, Ahmed Johnson, and the Road Warriors defeated the Nation of Domination, Farouk, D'Lo, Kama Mustafa, and Rocky Maivia. In a traditional Survivor Series match, survivor was Ken Shamrock, who made The Rock tap out.
Look at that intensity. There's the arm bar, submission. No, he's going to flip down. Come in. He's locked in. The ankle lock. Shamrock's ankle lock. And Maivia gets up, and Shamrock survived.
Chapman, that's a few months ago. He was talking about how he was never a fan of Ken Shamrock. And then a few weeks later, he's like, you know, I'm pretty sure it was you. You didn't really change your tune, but you kind of come around a little more to him. Am I thinking of you?
Yeah, I've never, you know, I was never, looking back, I was never a fan of Shamrock's, kind of watching some of the stuff. You know, yeah, he was a good worker, I guess, but I still, you know, he was never one of my fan favorites, or, you know, I would have never had him in a main event.
You know, to make that MMA crossover and to learn as fast as he did is pretty impressive.
Yeah, yeah.
But you got to look at, man, yeah, you know, and I agree with that, but you know, you look at guys that have come over, and I'll bring up Lesnar, and yeah, Lesnar started out at the WWE first, but Lesnar went and made a huge name for himself in the UFC, and then was able to transition back just like that. Went right back in. He's three times the performer that Ken Shamrock was, probably three times the fighter Ken Shamrock was. But he's just over. You know, everybody, you know, no matter what you say or love him or hate him or whatever, Brock Lesnar is the man. I mean, he's made his name for himself in both. He's very popular. Everybody right now knows who Brock Lesnar is.
Well, you know, I think transitioning from an MMA fighter to a professional wrestler is not an easy task. I think a perfect example is Cain Velasquez. You know, I mean, that was a complete flop, future endeavored before he really ever even got to do anything. And rightfully so, he wasn't ready to be on a national level.
Tank Abbott. You're forgetting the great Tank Abbott. That's a joke. I'm kidding. He nearly knifed a man on Nitro.
I'm not going to say I wasn't necessarily a fan of Tank Abbott, because I think, you know, I was a fan of Tank Abbott, but I was a fan of his comedy stuff, if that makes any sense. You know, the stuff that he did with Three Count. Yes, Three Count. The stuff he did with Three Count, I thought was good. It, you know, kind of showed that he was a character. Or that he could play a character or whatever. But, you know, Ken Shamrock, I, when he came into the WWF, he was on fire, man. I mean, that guy was literally pushed to the moon for obvious reasons. You know, with his MMA background and stuff, he was pivotal in early UFC, you know. I think he won the UFC, like, championship at three or maybe fought for it.
Yeah, he won some of the earlier tournaments.
Yeah, it was one of the earlier tournaments, but you know, he was great. And, you know, he worked really well with certain wrestlers. Like, if you look back at the time, the series of matches that he had with The Rock, they were pretty entertaining, you know?
Yeah, but really look back and show me a bad Rock match. Even back when he was Rocky Maivia, the dude could always work. He didn't have the gimmick down like he needed to, but he's always been able to work with
just the difference in those two is The Rock grew up in the business. Shamrock was an actual legit fighter.
Yeah.
But that's what I'm saying. I mean, I feel like The Rock can make just about anybody look good.
Good point.
Yeah, good point.
Chapman makes a good point. We'll give him credit. This would be LOD's final pay-per-view appearance as a tag team champions, by the way. So, six-match Stone Cold Steve Austin defeated Owen Hart by pinfall after a Stone Cold Stunner to become the new WWF Intercontinental Champion.
Austin again. Oh, Austin, the Stunner! The Stone Cold Stunner! Austin, the champion! Steve Austin is the new Intercontinental Champion!
Owen rocking that Owen 316 shirt. Says, I just broke your neck. This was a rematch from their SummerSlam where Owen actually did break Austin's neck. This was Austin's first match since then.
Can you believe that WWE did, or WWF at the time didn't run with that as a shirt? You know, that wasn't official merchandise. I saw something, you know, about that, and I couldn't believe it. You know, I know he was heel and everybody loved Austin, but That was a pretty clever phrase that he had.
It'd be worth some money now too.
Make sure. Do what?
It'd probably be worth some money now too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Or at least
a collector's item. Yeah. Yeah. One of a kind.
This match only lasted 4 minutes, and you can tell they were both working pretty cautiously. Not only because Austin's neck, but Owen had suffered a concussion just a few weeks prior.
Yeah. Yeah. Boy, as short as that match was. And they must have teased the pile driver 4 or 5 different times on that. Like, you're just waiting for it. You're waiting for it. It's like you see him go to do it, then, of course, bust out. And I don't know. It was kind of suspenseful, to be honest with you.
See a vignette for WWF Attitude. And here we go, main event, now infamously known as the Montreal Screwjob.
November the 9th, 1997, professional wrestler Bret Hart had fought and clawed his way to the top as world champion. But in a matter of seconds, he would realize that those who make you can just as easily destroy you.
Seventh match of the night, Shawn Michaels, the WWF European champion at the time, defeated Bret Hart by submission with a sharpshooter to become the new WWF world champion.
Oh, Michaels just pulled a referee right in front of the hitman. What about that? Michaels pulled referee Earl Hebner right in front of Bret Hart. And I think Hart and the referee hit head.
Is that a disqualification?
It might be if he could get up and call it. Are you going to try to beat Bret Hart with a sharpshooter? Yes, he is. Are you kidding me?
And obviously, this was Bret's final WWF pay-per-view.
Yeah. Man, what a rivalry. What a rivalry they had, you know. And this being the take home, the this is it, that just, I don't know. I think a lot of the speculation that, you know, has surrounded, you know, this match, when you look back on it, you still, you know, I mean, like, as a fan, you're watching it today, you can almost see it coming, especially knowing what we know now, the way that the promo that they had earlier went down. It just makes you wonder, like, is it a work? And we're here, what you said, 23 years later, going, man, that could have been a work. That could have been. It's crazy. Crazy. Yeah.
Bret comes off the top rope. Shawn pulls referee Earl Hebner between them. They all go down. Shawn locks in the sharpshooter. Hebner quickly gets back up. Vince gives the command. Earl signs a signal for the bell. Lots to unpack here. The whole building really didn't know what was going on. Triple H, Gerald Briscoe, and security immediately grab Shawn Michaels and take the belt and rush him to the back. Shawn looked confused, but I think it's pretty good acting job there. Yeah. Hebner shagged ass and was in his motel room less than half an hour after this.
Yeah, rumor has it there was a car waiting for him.
Yeah. Brett realized he'd been screwed out of the WWF Championship in front of 20,000 Canadians in a worldwide audience. And he was a little bit pissed. Fans caught on. They start throwing trash in the ring, start throwing trash at Shawn. Brett spits in the face of McMahon, flips off
it
the...
it took him every bit of 2 seconds to pop up. As soon as Brett, yeah. as soon as the bell rang, Brett stood straight up, no-sold anything.
I was going to talk about a no-sell, Brett.
And just and hawked the biggest loogie that he could conjure up and just spit right. You couldn't have wrote a book the way that the cameraman was right there. I mean, you couldn't have planned that out any better than what you know. The cameraman's right there, and what do you remember about that? There's a couple of things that you'll remember about that ending. Number one, you know, the loogie that's run down McMahon's face and him wiping it or whatever, and two.
WCW. Yeah, spits in the face, flips off backstage.
We're talking about good actors, we might as well give Bret Hart a shout out too.
Huh? Yeah. You. I tell you what. Yeah.
23 years later, he's still acting like he's screwed and doesn't know it.
Well, you know, everybody knows who screwed Bret. Everybody knows that Bret screwed Bret. I don't know. That match, if you could almost even call it a match, I don't know, if you go back and get a chance to rewatch it, man, they just beat the piss out of each other. That's all they did. It wasn't a real technical match. It was just a lot of big spots and a lot of punches and a lot of kicks. It was crazy, you know, especially because, you know, both of them are arguably two of the best technical wrestlers to ever, you know, lace up a pair of boots.
Yeah. Again, we've talked about him spitting in the face, doing the WCW, breaks some monitors, flips off the backstage. Mm-hmm. Some of this wasn't shown on the pay-per-view, but did make the documentary Wrestling with Shadows. Once Brett goes to the back, he confronts Shawn, who him and Triple H both deny any involvement. McMahon had already holed up in one of his offices with some of his stooges. Hart tries to break the door down, and of course this is all, you know, rumor, innuendo and hearsay, but eventually Brett and Vince have a confrontation. Hart punches Vince. McMahon suffers an ankle injury and a black eye. Brett broke his right hand from delivering the uppercut. Vince was knocked loopy, had to be helped out of the locker room area, and I forgot who it was helping him walk.
I think Briscoe
Madison, both of them.
McMahon told everybody in the locker room.
Video.
Yeah, McMahon tells everybody
Shane,
in the locker
room.
Shane was there. Shane and Briscoe.
Pretty iconic video of him
stumbling,
you know, walking down that hallway with the
spaghetti legs.
Licking his wounds.
He tells the locker room to, you know, everybody to keep quiet. He'll take the heat. Davey Boy Smith, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, Brian Crush Adams, and Rick Rude all end up quitting this night over that. Mick Foley quit for a day, no-showed the following Raw, but ended up coming back the next week. Bulldog had to pay six figures to get out of his contract, but he did. Owen Hart, they wouldn't let him out of his contract. But Rick Rude, probably the most infamous person to leave, only because how he did it. He did go, I think, two tapings after this, but on November 17th, unexpectedly showed up on Nitro, caused him to be on the same show, Raw and Nitro, on the same night. And
only person ever in history to do that.
No, absolutely he's not. Nope. Remember, Vince McMahon held everybody's fate in the palm of his hand. Vince McMahon.
Vince and Shane, both.
Yeah. I think that was the deal. Hold the fate in your hands or something like that.
Okay, so he was the only one in the history that actually did it where nobody else knew about it.
Probably.
No, I think – did Lex Luger do that too? No.
No, but
– the very first Nitro?
He did.
The
very
first Nitro, but yeah. He was not on
– was he not on Raw? Right. Raw prior to that? Okay.
A week after this, Vince did his famous interview, most remembered for saying, Brett screwed Brett.
Let's cut right to the chase. 7 days ago at the Survivor Series, did you or did you not screw Bret Hart. Some would say, I screwed Bret Hart. Bret Hart would definitely tell you, I screwed him. I look at it from a different standpoint. I look at it from a standpoint of the referee did not screw Bret Hart. Shawn Michaels certainly did not screw Bret Hart. Nor did Vince McMahon screw Bret Hart. I truly believe that Bret Hart screwed Bret Hart. And he can look in the mirror and know that.
I'm sure in some parts of the country right now there's a collective groan that you're not accepting responsibility, that you orchestrated the situation, and the fact that people are not going to understand what you mean by Bret Hart screwed Bret Hart. So what do you mean by that?
Well, I will certainly take responsibility for any decision I've ever made. I've never had a problem doing that. Not that all of my decisions are accurate. They're not. But when I make a bad decision, I'm not above saying I'm sorry and trying to do the best about it that I can. Hopefully the batting average is pretty good. I make more good decisions than I do bad decisions. And as far as screwing Bret Hart is concerned, there's a time-honored tradition in the wrestling business that when someone is leaving, that they show the right amount of respect to the WWF superstars, in this case, who helped make you that superstar. You show the proper respect to the organization that helped you become who you are today. It's a time-honored tradition, and Bret Hart didn't want to honor that tradition. And that's something I would have never, ever expected from Bret, because he is known somewhat as a traditionalist in this business. It would have never crossed my mind that Bret would not have wanted to show the right amount of respect to the superstars who helped make him, and the organization who helped make him what he is today. Nonetheless, that was Bret's decision. Bret screwed Bret.
Yeah. Yeah. That really, you know, don't get me wrong, Austin versus McMahon was iconic, but you know, when you think about it, the timeline, that is what segued Vince McMahon into, yep, Mr. McMahon. You know,
exactly.
He, at that point, that's when he became the biggest heel in the company. You know, yep. How could you screw Bret like that? Because regardless of whatever happened, the fans perceived it as Vince McMahon screwing him over. Yeah. And the rest is history. It's crazy, you know, because prior to that, you know, Vince McMahon was a broadcast journalist, you know, an announcer. He didn't, you know, he didn't know he was owner of the company. And, you know, that kind of catapulted him into the spotlight, so to speak.
Yeah, you're right. It gave birth to the Mr. McMahon character. Helped launch Stone Cold Steve Austin's rivalry. As for Bret, he shows up on Nitro, or actually he doesn't show up the next night, but on the next night they do announce that he was coming to WCW, and on December 15th he made his Nitro debut. And while he's in WCW, I think it's pretty lackluster. I don't think they used him properly. Not his fault. I just don't think they knew what to do with him.
Yeah, well, you know, Vince probably made the right business decision at the time to let Bret out of that big contract. I think didn't Bret come back and say, because he'd signed a multi million dollar 10-year deal or something, and Vince let him out of it to pursue the WCW.
I think a 20-year contract.
Yeah, 20-year
contract. Which was unheard of at the time.
Yeah, yeah, it's crazy, you know. There's so much of that that the fans will never know about. You know, even people like us, you know, who might think they have an insight, we're just not going to know exactly what happened, you know, during that whole time. No. Again, you know, you go back and you watch this, knowing what we know now, you can almost see it, you know, you can almost see it coming. And was it a work? I don't know. Was it put in front of you and done so perfect that here we are 23 years later, still asking ourselves, like, it could have been, because it really could have been, you know, those guys, I don't know. They left a lot of people. They left enough room for people to speculate still, right, 23 years later.
Bret was fired from WCW in October of 2000. And about a week later, he announced his retirement. possibly one of the most creative finishes ever in a wrestling match, and both Jim Cornette and Vince Russo take credit for it.
So when Vince says, well, how would you do it then? Bret's hold is the sharpshooter, but let Sean get Bret's hold on him. If the referee just calls for the bell as a submission, nobody can tell anything was wrong because that's what it's supposed to look like anyway. And to tell anybody anything was wrong, I said, Bret Hart, of all people, would have to expose the business. I said, what's he going to do, call the newspapers? But then Vince, and he gave that humph like he does whenever you would be discussing tomfoolery, and he would say, all right, let's get back to reality. And we went on.
Unless I was in the bathroom during that scenario did not take place in front of me when I was sitting at the table. I'm not going to call Jim Cornette a liar. And when I was sitting at the table and Cornette was sitting at the same table, I pitched that exact scenario to Vince. So basically, out of pure frustration, I said, screw it, Vince. Have Sean put the sharpshooter on Bret and have the referee call for the bell. Do that. People tell me all the time, oh, Vince, you take credit for the Montreal Screwjob. I wish I didn't pitch the idea. That was a miserable night. It was one of the worst experiences in my life in the wrestling business.
I swear on my mother's grave, my father's grave, my wife's life, and my dog's life, the story I just told you is true. Vince Russo is the biggest liar in professional wrestling, and imagine the territory that takes in.
Scott Hall thinks it's a work.
You say the Montreal Screwjob is that nobody knows if it was really a screwjob or not. I happen to believe it was the real deal.
To me, I feel the same way now seeing it back as I did the first time I saw it. It's a total work. Everybody was in on it, and they all did it together. Now look at Bret's face. He doesn't look too shocked to me. You're going to spit on Vince, and then the truck is going to go tight on Vince, get Vince wiping the loogie out of his eye. Vince has been in the TV business his whole life. Nothing's going to happen without his consent.
Everybody knows you're leaving. You're going to stand in what's now your opposition's ring on a global broadcast, and you're going to motion the call signs of your competitor. If that's not okayed by a big boss, in my mind, they're going to cut away from that. I mean, I've never discussed it with Sean, and I wasn't there, and I didn't ask guys who were there. Watching it as an educated fan, I would say it was a complete collaboration by all parties. And that's all I got to say about that.
People do say it was a work, and Bret was in on it. No, man, this is the way this piece of history went down.
It's ludicrous that Scott Hall would say that he didn't talk to Shawn Michaels about this. I know they all talk to each other about everything, but especially about this. Why wouldn't they? I will tell anybody to their face that thinks that this was a work, you are a dumb, stupid...
Poor Earl. He's just a little guy. I feel so bad for him. Like, to put that on him was such a rotten thing to do.
For the last 15 years, it's been the shits. That's always a chant in any arena as you screw Bret. We never talked for a long, long time, many years. Even though Bret and I are friends now, this is still upsetting. I guess you could tell I'm kind of break it down a little bit, but it's something that will be with me forever.
The Montreal Screwjob is remembered all kinds of different ways by all kinds of different people. For the fans, it was like one of the first big behind-the-scenes things that exploded and they heard about and they realized that there was more intrigue in the locker room and in the boardroom than there sometimes was in the ring.
Bret has his perspective. Sean has his perspective. Neither have ever said that it was a work. Supposedly it's all water under the bridge now, but what do you guys think? Put you on the spot. Do you think it was a work? Do you think it was a shoot?
I think it was a work.
Oh man. I don't know. I want to say that it was a shoot, just simply because there was so much animosity over the years between Vince McMahon and Vince McMahon's proved that he'll work with anybody. But, you know, it took 14, you know, no, I guess, when did Bret kind of come back? What, 2010-ish, maybe? It took 14 years to come back. I don't know. You know, I think the fans were wanting to see him. The WWE fans were wanting to see Bret back way before he came back. And I don't know. I don't know. I think it was legit. I think it was a shoot.
There's no reason why they would have shown him giving the WCW signal.
Well,
to this day, still doing it. There's no way.
If you go back at the end of this on the network, it doesn't show it. And it should.
Oh, did they pulled it out?
They pulled it out. I don't know if it made the paper. It made the documentary.
Are they still working? You know, it's like you know, that's a long con right there. You know,
it made the documentary, but I don't know.
Right there, boy.
Yeah. So if it's a shoot, who do you side with? Do you think Brett got screwed, or do you lean towards Vince doing what he had to do to protect?
Here's the deal. You know, do you have another Medusa segment on WCW 9?
Or Shane Douglas.
You know, the last thing at that point in time that they needed was their champion showing up on you know, Nitro, trashing their championship belt. You know, at the end of the day, if it was a shoot, you know, Brett's got to take a little bit of responsibility for it. You know, he was obviously disgruntled. Way before this happened, you know, you can't put a promoter on the spot like that, you know.
So, I disagree. You have to go with loyalty. Brett didn't even want to leave.
But you think it's a work, Chapman, so it doesn't matter what you think.
Yeah, you said that we're going off of a what-if situation here. What if it's a shoot?
Okay, what if it's a shoot? You side with Brett?
Yeah, I would side with Brett.
I think, and I get what you're saying. I think there was probably a way they both could have done this right. But end of the day, Vince, that's his company. That's his belt. He's got to protect
it. You know what the sad truth is let's just say, hypothetically say, that Brett didn't go to WCW. He didn't have that match with Bill Goldberg. He wasn't forced to retire. Could he still be working today?
Well, let's take it a step further. Let's say Davey Boy didn't quit and go to WCW and break his back and get addicted to the pain pills. Would he still be alive today?
He very well could.
Would Owen Hart still be alive, because there'd be a Hart Foundation and he wouldn't have to do the Blue Blazer game?
Man, we're getting deep. This night could have changed lots of history if it would have went a different direction.
Yeah, you're right.
Would there have been a Stone Cold Steve Austin era?
Yeah. You know, let's just say, you know, think about that. McMahon versus Austin. It could have never happened if Brett and Austin continued their feud. You know, they would have went into the Royal Rumble, and the birth of you know, the infamous Vince McMahon could have never happened. You know, or at least maybe not at that time. But you know, could that gimmick have worked with anybody else? You know, with Stone Cold being an anti-hero. Could the Mr. McMahon character have worked against, you know, Mankind? I don't think it could.
I don't even think, you know, if they would have went through and did this finish like it was done, but planned on keeping Brett, I don't even think Brett and McMahon could have had the kind of chemistry that Austin did. In my opinion, Austin was a way better talker than Brett was. You know, Brett always did his promos, and he kind of had that heart. It was kind of like, you know, I'm still the really good guy, and good Austin who goes out there with the attitude and like, I don't care, this is how it is, you know, F you. And I just think that I don't think anybody could have had the Austin McMahon chemistry.
They had good chemistry, that's for sure. Especially, you know, that was a big bang, you know, for you know, professional wrestling. Just that, you know, that it was pivotal. It was pivotal for, you know, the next, you know, 3, 4, 5 years for WWF.
You know, where would Owen be at today?
What about The Rock? He was Rocky Maivia with the Nation of Domination here. I mean, maybe he would have never got the shot he got.
Boy, I tell you what, you know, he was sure on the rise at that point. I mean, you could see it. You know, he grabbed the stick and worked it for a second, and man, that guy, you could just see it that he was something special. Yeah.
This is kind of off kilter. I just watched a deal last week. It was Jake Roberts talking, and Jake found out that they had signed Austin as ringmaster or whatever. Jake, I guess, had watched some of his ECW promos and stuff, and Jake told Vince McMahon, said, "That's your next mega superstar." And Vince looked at him and said, "Really?" And never was.
And it's a time, we touched on it a little bit earlier. We were talking about Shamrock and just his place in wrestling at the time. But, you know, Shamrock and Rock, they were just, I thought that they put on a good series of matches. And you know, Shamrock thought enough of it that, you know, that I want to say, what was it, 2-3 weeks ago that The Rock inducted Ken Shamrock into the Impact Hall of Fame. I mean, was that kind of a bizarre world situation right there? You know, but that's a testament to you know, to, I guess, their friendship or whatever, that after all these years, you know, 23 years later, you know, they're still buddies, and they still have that mutual respect for each other, you know, when it comes to professional wrestling.
So I put that on Twitter and asked our followers who they sided with, Vince or Brett, and 46% sided with Vince and 54% sided with Brett. So
yeah, of course, you know,
Brett's a baby face.
That's what I was going to say. Stephen E is siding. Yeah, you know, what are you going to do? It's close any which way you put it, you know, and it's a close, you know, when you put
in work in history.
Yeah, when you put in a little bit of margin and error, they might be pretty much neck and neck. You know, I don't know. Here we are, 23 years later, and we're still talking about whether it's a work or not. I don't know. I think that proves that job well done, Jim Cornette, Vince Russo, and whoever else wrote that show.
Yeah, both take credit. Both says the other one's full of crap. Both say it was a shoot. Both say they came up with the idea, and Brett had no idea about it. That's the other thing. It's been 23 years. Don't you think by now, because kayfabe, you know, it's.
But have with Bret Hart. You know, you got to look at that real hard, man. Bret Hart, you know, from Canada, from the Hart Dungeon, the Hart family. Kayfabe is kayfabe, guys. I mean, that's like the bottom.
Yeah. Kayfabe is kayfabe, but, you know, like, how do you put the promoter on the spot like that? You know, I mean, like, you talk about loyalty and you talk about you got to be loyal, but, you know, here you got a promoter and his number one guy that he let out of his contract.
He didn't let him out. He forced him. Brett didn't want to leave. Brett didn't want to go to WCW. Vince called him and said, can you still get that deal? Because I can't pay you what I promised.
Yeah, but at the end of the day, you think he took a pay cut to go to WCW?
Oh, yeah.
You know, he didn't take a pay cut. He was making big money, I'm sure. At the end of the day, you shouldn't force the promoter's hand, you know? I know Brett said something about that he would come back and he would lose it the next night in you know, Detroit or somewhere. I think it was in Michigan. But, you know, if he didn't and he showed up on Monday, you know, the contract was done. This is something that they should have really figured out prior to, you know, going on. But
pretty similar to the Jeff Jarrett situation that would happen, you know, years later. But they thought they had a deal with him and he shows up and says, I'm not coming on this pay-per-view until you pay me my money.
Well, yeah, cut me a check.
I think one thing we could all agree on is whether it was a work then or not, they've definitely made it a work now.
Yeah. It's going to be one of the mysteries of professional wrestling for a very long time.
As Cornette says, sometimes the behind-the-scenes stuff is a lot more interesting than the in-ring stuff. And definitely a case.
Will we ever know the truth? I don't know. I don't think we will. You know, but it definitely makes you think. You know, like I said, it took 10, 11, 12 years, 13 years for Brett to come back to WWF. You know, I don't think the Warrior had that long of a run, you know, between stints, you know, and Jeff Jarrett certainly didn't have that much of a run. And you know, I thought Jeff was somebody we would never see again. So whenever he came back and did that last little run, you know, I was pretty surprised and, you know, actually pretty entertained by the whole deal. But
I think he's still employed by him as a producer or something.
Yeah, he's backstage talent. So. Yeah. What do you guys think? You got a favorite match?
Oh, man.
Is it the Godwins and the Headbangers?
You know, if we don't put the Truth Commission over right now, I'm going to riot. I'm rioting. Now, you know, obviously, when you look back on this, you know, Survivor Series 97 is going to be known for one thing. You know, obviously, the debut of Steve Blackman. you know, this right here, it's infamous. You know, it's one of those pay-per-views that people are always going to talk about. You know, when you talk about Survivor Series 97, you're talking about Shawn and Bret. That's it.
Yeah, I think the Austin and Owen match was interesting, just knowing that they were both taking it easy because Austin's neck and Owen's. But yeah, I mean, Shawn and Bret, here we are 23 years later, probably forever.
And we didn't really get to touch on you know, the crowd. You know, the crowd, anytime, especially during that period, anytime they were up in Canada, it was an altered universe, so to speak. You know, the people cheered, of course, the Hart Foundation, and it just went crazy for him and booed everybody else. You know, it was kind of, like I said, topsy-turvy. It was flipped, which was interesting because, you know, you get used to watching them run on American, you know, cities or stadiums, arenas or whatever. And then, you know, everybody kind of cheers for the good guys and, you know, boos the bad guys. But then they go up there and it's turned around. It's bizarro.
Yeah, and this Team USA, it's almost like they had superstars, a grid of their pictures, and they just threw something. And, oh, Vader. Oh, Goldust. Oh, Mark Merrill. Oh, Blackman.
Well, I mean, you know, in professional wrestling, the one formula that always works is USA versus whoever. You know, it doesn't matter. You can take a person from Canada, from, you know, Mexico, wherever, and, you know, USA versus the Foreign Legion. I think
Truth Commission.
Some foreign coalition versus USA. And, you know, wouldn't it be great to have that going on right now and have Hacksaw Jim Duggan as the manager of these guys?
Yeah.
Well, USA.
Speaking of Hacksaw, thumbs up, thumbs down, thumbs in the middle.
I'm gonna go up just because we're still talking about it.
Yeah.
But mainly because of that match. Now, if that match wasn't there, you know, this pay per view overall would have got like a 1 star.
Well, yeah, it wasn't. The matches weren't the greatest, but the storytelling behind it, I think, is what really stole the show. Again, when you go through and you Truth Commission, I don't know if they would be in. If they were in a 1 star match, you know, I think we'd be giving them too much credit. They just were horrible. Bret and Shawn, I mean, I'm telling you, when you go back and you rewatch that, it is a slug fest. They are just beating the piss out of each other. But again, here we are 23 years later talking about it. It's going to go down in history as one of the most controversial pay-per-views of all time, I think.
Yep. We mentioned Davey Boy Smith earlier. His son, Davey Boy Smith Jr., MLW, is coming back next week. And I'm really looking forward to that. If you guys haven't checked it out, check it out. They're going to start coming on, I think it's 6 o'clock before NXT and before AEW. It's just an hour long. So I know I convinced Chapman to check it out one time, and he thought it was okay. So it's really definitely worth checking out.
I'll let you in on a little secret. I've never watched an MLW match. I shame on me. I've heard good things about it. I just haven't gotten a chance to.
Yeah, I'm gonna tell you what. I turned it on. Colonel Robert Parker came out. You know,
I'm sold. Why? Yeah, I'm sold.
You got Robert Parker. You got Pillman Jr., Dave Boy Smith Jr. You got the Von Erich boys. It's they got a good thing going.
Yeah.
And Filthy Tom Waller, which I'm sure you're familiar with.
I know exactly who Filthy Tom Waller is.
And Dan Lambert's in there now, too. Founder of the American Top Team.
Is it True Braid, Filthy Tom Waller? Does he put the little braids in his hair still?
No, he's I haven't saw him in a few months, but before it was pretty short, so.
Yeah.
But man, he's actually really good on the mic.
Really?
Yeah.
Really? You know, I guess in today's day and age, you would compare him to, how would you compare him to Riddle, you know, Matt Riddle, those guys kind of both are the same pedigree.
I tell you one funny, he was feuding with the Von Erichs, and I can't remember, I think it was Lance Von Erich, who was like a fake Von Erich brother in WCCW years ago.
Yeah.
Well, part of this storyline was Lawler, Filthy Tom Lawler's on the mic. He's like, I got a secret weapon. He's a real Von Erich. He's the son of Lance Von Erich.
He brought him out.
He brought out the fake son of the fake Von Erich. It was great.
The son of the fake Von Erich. That's brilliant. That's good stuff. Yeah, I'll have to check that out, man. Some of the names that you mentioned right there. You know, I mean, come on, Colonel Robert Parker. Why haven't I been watching this? You know,
they had Schiavone and Cornette for a while, but Cornette, you know, did his usual Cornette thing, and he's no longer apart.
I gotta ask: Is Parker doing his gimmick?
He's got the white suit.
He looks the same age. He's like J.J. Dillon and Arn Anderson. Colonel Parker looks the same age as he has for 25 years.
Does it work? I mean, is it working?
Yeah.
He's the general manager or something, isn't he?
He's just a manager.
I gotta watch it, man. I gotta tune into that. I'm a manager kind of guy for some reason, and I can't believe I haven't caught on to that yet. You know anything? Colonel Robert Parker, man, boy, did that take me back in the day, you know.
Jump Rope Academy.
Yeah, I'm telling you.
Hey, before we go, I want to give a shout-out real quick to the Blue Chew, okay? Nobody knows more about Blue Chew than this man right here, the manager of champions. Steven, tell him.
Well, I tell you what.
You got a Blue Chew story?
I don't have a Blue Chew story, as a matter of fact. I wish I did have a Blue Chew story, but... I don't have a Blue Chew story, you know. I'm kind of stuck it there. Put that straighten that up a little bit.
There we go. who's that on the table? Is that a gurney or a table?
That is
I can see Sting. Halloween
Havoc. That is a Subway poster for Halloween Havoc 1990. It's got the Sting and the Horseman. And Sid Vicious is on a kind of like an electric table, kind of a Frankenstein table, it's good stuff. You know, the lights, blurring Sting's face out a little bit, but it's pretty cool. Yeah, it's a pretty cool little poster that I picked up along the way. One of the things about me that you may not know is I am a memorabilia collector. Of all sorts, anything wrestling related. I love to have right behind me over my left shoulder is a flyer from, I think, 1958, Big Bob Orton versus the Elastic, Tiny Mills and Jack Mills versus Patton O'Connor and Sonny Myers. You know, of course, Sonny Myers from St. Joseph, Missouri, just a legend in this business. I've heard a lot of great Sonny stories over the years and how tough that guy was, and don't mess with his trees, you know? It's one of my favorite pieces. It's from, I think we got it pegged down to, I think, 1958.
Nice. So, do you have any belts? Yeah.
Big shout out to a wrestling historian, Mike Isles, for pinning that date down.
Do you have any belts?
You know, I don't have any here at the house. I have four or five of them right now. I've got a autographed AWA replica signed by Jerry Lawler, Kurt Hennig, and Amy Hennig. Nice. Kind of a weird combination, but Kurt and Amy were down at a Harley show, and somebody got it. I picked it up along the way, but somebody took it to the show and. Got that, and oh shoot, what else do I got? I got a network championship, and believe it or not, I've got a UFC championship replica, and
big gold Ric Flair autograph.
Yeah, I did. I had that one. What was the MMA company that UFC bought out back in like 2012 or so? Uriah Faber.
Yeah, WEC.
I've got a WEC replica title, which is really, 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 really hard to come by because, you know, it's not been around for almost 10 years. And it's a pretty cool title belt. But I've got more memorabilia than I know what to do with.
Jay-Z Flair's been on the show before, and he's a big belt collector. So is Conrad Thompson, by the way. Big belt collector.
Yeah. Who was a big belt collector?
Jay-Z Flair. He's been on podcast a few times.
Yeah.
You've got, what, 4 or 5 of them big drums full of magazines.
Oh, man. Let me tell you a story. I had purchased a lot of magazines, and whenever I say a lot of them, I had probably 75, early 90s through 2007. I bought them off of a guy, and a lot of them were, the WWF magazines. In fact, actually, I take that back. It wasn't early 90s. A lot of them were early 80s, because I had a lot of the early WWF magazines. Well, I had somebody call me up and ask me, would you be interested in some magazines? And I thought, I just bought a bunch of them. I think I'll hold off on them. And the lady goes, no, you don't understand. I'd let you have them if you come and pick them up. And I made arrangements for a guy to go pick them up. And they sat in back of one of my shops for a good 6 months unopened. I'd never opened them up. They were in like a 30-gallon drum, with one of the metal seals. You pop it. Well, anyways, Chapman was up, and he's just made mention, yeah, have you been through those magazines yet? I said, no, let's go back there and look. And I tell you what, when I opened that drum, there was like a light underneath. You remember the old urn gimmick where they pop the lid and light would come up? It was just like that. I mean, you talk about a gold mine of professional wrestling magazines. It was insane. I'm talking mint condition magazines from the 60s. Mint condition magazines from the 50s. There was the earliest one that I found was a Japanese newspaper, wrestling newspaper, I guess what the best way to describe it, from 1949. It was insane. And, to this day, that's one of my prized pieces in my collection, is this group of magazines that somebody gave me. Very rarely will I go even and look at them. I put them all in sleeves and all that good stuff, because when I say mint condition, I'm talking mint condition, Nathan. It's almost like you just stepped in a time machine and went back to the magazine stand. And I'm not gonna guarantee that the one at the magazine stand is any better condition than the one that I have, 40 years later, 50 years later. It's crazy, especially seeing a lot of the old 60s magazines where, there's one with Bobby Heenan who is just busted wide open. I mean, he is truly an example of a crimson mask. This guy is just busted open. But, my magazine collection is second to none. I went down to New Orleans and worked a show down in New Orleans, Mid-South reunion show. And Jim Cornette was there, and we got to talking, and Jim's a big magazine guy as well. And, before it was all over, Jim's got his card, with his, phone number and all that stuff on it, telling me, he's like, well, do me a favor, categorize them, by date, and send all that to me. And I'd gladly take some of them off your hands. And I'm sitting there going, it would take me 3 months to put all these, just 3 months at 4 or 5 hours a day would be, I'd be lucky to get through it. And needless to say, I'd never contacted Jim about it, and don't really want to get rid of him, not quite yet.
Yeah, well, one of these days I'd like to check that out if I ever get over this crud. And
yeah, you come up and we'll definitely go back in the day. I've always thought, wouldn't it be cool to have just like a memorabilia room and to get like an old magazine rack? Well, does he have an old magazine rack?
Well, he's got, a little bit I saw, he's got a whole room that he does. And I think he's got them all lined up, on the wall.
You remember the old magazine racks from the grocery stores, Walmart, yeah, stuff like that. I just want one like that. And, you know, you don't ever have to. When I was a kid, when we'd go to those, you'd look. And the only way I could find the wrestling section is if you looked for the bodybuilding section. Because if you look for the big dude, you know, flexed out, you know, the wrestling magazines are somewhere, you know, somewhere in that vicinity. But I like to get something like that and put it in a tribute room or a throwback room, you know, and do it right, set them all out, and then have friends over, and we could all just geek out, you know, geek out.
I'm surprised you trust Chapman around these magazines.
Yeah, no kidding. And my house is liable to catch fire, knock on wood, you know, after Chapman. But no, you know, funny story. I had Bobby Eaton in my shop doing an autograph session, and we were talking one time, and I mentioned, you know, my magazine collection. He goes, oh, you know, you gotta, you know, could you bring up some of those? You know, so I grabbed probably 50-100 of them, and man, I tell you what, you know, sitting there watching Bobby go through these magazines, Bobby talked about how, you know, when he came up in wrestling, that you know, that was really frowned upon by promoters and by the workers. And, you know, it was like watching a 12-year-old kid just flip through those magazines. It was insane. It was very, 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 very cool.
That's awesome. Well, guys, that about wraps it up. Follow us on Facebook at The Slop Drop, on Twitter at The Slop Drop 1. Wherever you find your podcast, we're probably there. Leave us a good rating, a good review. And as always, thank you for listening. And until next time, we're out of here.
Goodbye and good night.
1, 2, 3.